You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wood.
And I'm Jennifer Connor.
From Equestrian Businesswomen, and you're listening to Equestrian B2B, the podcast that brings together industry leaders, entrepreneurs, and equestrians for conversations about how they build and sustain a successful business.
On today's show, we speak with magazine publisher, podcast host, pony owner, rider, and educator Piper Clem about the power of showing up in person consistently and building your community.
Piper Clem is the owner and publisher of The Plaid Horse. Her mission is to educate young equestrians in every facet of our industry and to empower young women in particular to find their voices and stories and to share them. She has spent her entire career focusing on education through various channels, including The Plaidcast, North America's most listened to horse show podcast, co-authoring the Show Strides book series, and by providing educational articles, grants, and experiential learning opportunities for riders of all ages and levels.
Piper earned her PhD in chemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. She lived in Hartford, Connecticut with her husband, Adam Hill, who is a chemistry professor at Trinity College. She owns a fleet of lease ponies and competes in the amateur hunter divisions with MTM Sandwich. Hi, friends. Connor here. I want to take a quick minute to tell you about my new endeavor. My partner, Chelsea, and I have developed the first peer-to-peer equestrian clothing rental marketplace. Think Airbnb for those unused clothes sitting in your closet. It's simple. You're going to rent, ride, and return. We're excited to connect equestrian closets across the country, helping to make equestrian fashion more affordable, accessible, and sustainable. So start cleaning out those closets and make some extra horse money. Check out ridersrent.com.
So we are talking today with Piper Clem, one of our friends and publisher of the Plaid Horse magazine and host of the Plaidcast podcast and one of our supporters of Equestrian Businesswomen. And I don't know how we've never had you on the podcast before, but we're really happy to talk to you today because I know one of the things we've always talked about is community. And that is something that's important to equestrian businesswomen, obviously, because that's something that we're trying to build. And it's something that I think has become increasingly important to you as well within the equestrian community and industry, I should say. So, you know, just in that, within talking about that, I think part of it kind of starts with your more personal life, right? In kind of where you used to live was pretty rural in New York, upstate New York, and moving to Connecticut. Why did you make that decision and how did that decision to move kind of shape how you're doing your business now?
Absolutely. My husband is a tenured professor of chemistry. He was at St. Lawrence for 10 years, which is why we were up there and not just rural, not just up there, New York, like way up there, New York, over 50% of Canadians live south of us. And, you know, not anywhere that you could drive 4 hours even to get anywhere, you know, and no highways, you know, no airports. And I walked the walk, you know, I did it for 10 years from there. I figured it out. I daisy chained trips together to go from this place to this place to this place. Because once you got out, you might as well, you know, stay out and keep going. I made a lot of stuff happen. Almost every Sunday night, I'd be driving home 7 to 10 hours from somewhere for 10 years. And, you know, and this is my husband's dream job, like on campus, he was very happy. But, the town really had nothing, and having nothing makes everything harder. Like there was one dry cleaners in town and it shut down while we were there. So I couldn't like get my dry cleaning done. And like, as much as this doesn't seem like as big of a deal now, you know, pre-COVID, people wore dry cleaned clothes to things.
Yeah.
had pressed outfits and like didn't wear sweatpants everywhere. You know, and it was hard to like look the part at a horse show without a dry cleaner. It was hard to, you know, every little thing about my life, it was hard to get in and out. It was hard to find help. It was hard to, you know, the littlest things, you know, get your washing machine repaired when it broke, or, you know, take care of things. And so, you know, I grew accustomed to it being this hard, and I knew that it didn't necessarily need to be this hard, and it was really hard on me. And yeah. I also, you know, on the flip side, when we started, we moved there when I was 25, like, it was very cheap to live there. We were able to save money. We were able to get on our feet financially. I wouldn't have been able to afford to get the plaid horse going without being there. So it's like this double-edged sword. But, you know, I felt like I had outgrown that a little bit. But meanwhile, my husband has 10-year a job for life at St. Lawrence University. And that's not a trivial thing to give up. And, you know, we talked over the years. I mean, there's also no like healthcare really up there and hospitals and, you know, and places you'd want to go to. So we had talked about not wanting to age there. But, you know, I don't think we saw the pathway. When I met my husband, the very first day I met him, I asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up. And he said a professor at Trinity College. And I was like, okay, I guess I can deal with that. It's very specific.
It was very specific.
And so it ended up being serendipitous timing. I had enough. I mean, I'm not like proud, but like we were going home from Kentucky one year at the end of the summer, and I had like a complete full on like meltdown temper tantrum. And I was like, I don't want to go back there.
I mean, 10 years is a long time to put up with that. And yep. I can't imagine the travel nightmares trying to get up there in the winter too.
Oh yeah. I mean, flights would get stuck for 2 or 3 days. I'd be in airport for days at a time. People said to me when I moved here, they're like, you lost weight. And I'm like, I literally don't spend one day a week stuck at an airport somewhere. Yeah.
And it must have felt so isolating too when you're there, when you're at home. I mean, being with your husband is great, but not having any kind of support network around you.
And he would be busy all day with people. So he'd be exhausted when he got home and like kind of his cup would be full and wanting to relax. And I'd be like, oh my God, I haven't seen another human today. And absolutely. That was really hard too. So we sat down and made a plan. We selected, I think, 9 universities that were places that I would rather live. One of them was Trinity. He ended up getting the offer from Trinity, and we moved to Hartford, Connecticut 2 years ago. And it has made my life better in ways that like I couldn't even have imagined. You know, it is truly every little thing is easier, you know, and I appreciate every second of everything.
Yeah, it's amazing. So my brother, he lives up in Queensbury, and they keep saying, oh, you should move up here. And I'm like, absolutely not. Like, if I were to be able to spend the winter in Florida and then come up there and spend the summer up there, that might be okay. But I do not want to be stuck. I grew up near Syracuse, so the snow, the isolation, like, I get it. And we lived in a very rural area outside of Syracuse, so I totally get where you're coming from. And, like, being stuck for days with snow, like, unimaginable how much you get up in those areas. And so I could totally appreciate you wanting to not be in that situation anymore. And where you're at in Hartford, I was so fortunate to be able to come to the podcast in person, and it was super fun. I really enjoyed it. And your apartment was like right across the street from that theater, and like so amazing that you're able to like just walk around and go to places. What I wanted to know is like, let's talk a little bit about supporting like the small businesses in your area, because you use this really cool theater that's right by your apartment. So can you talk about like getting into the community, digging into community?
Absolutely. We moved into downtown Hartford, which a lot of people work in Hartford. They don't really live in Hartford too much. So it's an interesting city that has a lot of vibrancy and a lot of culture, but then also like a lot of parking, and it's pretty easy to get around. I kind of tell everyone that it's like 70% of Boston or Manhattan at 30% of the price. Like, it's very economic for what it is. And so we have this public art museum, the first public art museum in North America. The Wadsworth Athenaeum is across the street from our house. It has incredible major paintings, huge exhibits all the time. And they have this theater that seats about 300, and There's original artwork of horses on the walls. It's this beautiful, grand, old theater. And there's so much historic architecture in Hartford and the building. And I love to be part of things that are old and things that last and things that stand the test of time. And, you know, Hartford is really full of that. And so to be able to connect our community, our horse community, with my direct radius, I mean, it's literally across the street. I can see it right out the window. It's cool to kind of think more hyper-local again after so many years of traveling. So many places, I want to travel forever. I love it. I love the Plaid Horse. I love meeting people everywhere. But I also, you know, want to kind of set up roots and invest in this local community. And I think if we look at the big, you know, dynastic families in our sport, the big dynastic groups of people who have made big change, they've done it by being together and being in person and having that stability that we don't always see anymore in today's version of our sport.
How do you think that hyper-local support in the area can lead to changes or can lead to more in the sport?
I think that you have conversations in person that you would never have anywhere else, not even on Zoom, not on podcasts, definitely not commenting on social media. And when I look at, you know, when I look critically back over, I think I've been doing this about 11 years with the Plaid Horse. And I, you know, I took some time, you know, with moving to like take stock in my life of like, where have I failed and where have I, you know, achieved things or wanted to do things that didn't quite get there? Where am I making progress? Where am I not? And I think that one of the things I evaluated in myself was that I want everyone to like me and I want everyone to agree with the things that, you know, not necessarily with me, but I want to come to a consensus where we all understand where we're going and we all want to do it. And that's so unrealistic. And then once you get social media on top of it, you have these like thousands of viewers, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands on some posts. And then all of a sudden, like you get 5,000 people having an opinion on something and like not all of them agree with you. And then you like doubt yourself. Is this a good idea? Should we move forward? And, you know, when I think about the structures that govern our sport, literally, I believe that USHJA was like formed by about 7 people sitting around a table. They didn't, in a good way, I'm not being negative, but they didn't care what everyone thought. They cared about what the people that they chose, whose opinions were educated, had different viewpoints than them. You know, you look at big programs like Derby Finals, like that was not a consensus of 5,000 people. That was a group,
right,
a small group pushing it forward. It's the old Margaret Mead quote of like, never, what is it? Something about never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has, or something like that, paraphrased. And I think that becoming hyper-local, like, and thinking about our communities is having people at the dinner table and letting conversation come up and letting people bring things up. One of the things that came up in a very early dinner at my house was we have a ton of hunters and equitation in New England, and we don't have a lot of jumper opportunities at the mid-level. We have like 4 and 5 stars here. You know, it's wonderful, but like that junior rider getting their feet wet, there aren't a ton of finals around here for that comparatively to how much we have going on for everything else. And that's like fixable. Like there are people at the table that night that run horse shows. There are people that, you know, at the table that night that, you know, have barns that would take people to those horse shows. So I think like even like little things, I think social media makes us want all these grandiose things. And, you know, incremental change. If I live here for, you know, hopefully ever, you know, and make 1% a change a year, that adds up so much. If I make 10% a change a year, that adds up so much. It's not this all or nothing approach. It's, can we sit at the table? Can we each improve something about our program? And, you know, we've already just like organically at the dinner table, you know, and at Plaghast Live, you know, people have hired other people and gotten, you know, new jobs and have helped people, you know, with advice on getting into school or meeting coaches or, you know, yeah, all of these layers of just organically, you know, let someone else borrow a lesson pony that they didn't need. You know, these all make the community better, and they're such minor things and there's no gold star for them for anyone involved. It's, yeah, just being a community. And I think we've lost that a little bit, and everyone wants to monetize everything and know their worth and all that kind of stuff. I've never known my worth. I work for free all the time. Every project I could imagine. And I think this is how we make the sport better. Everyone doing what they can and giving what they can, and people more fortunate giving more, and everyone having that ethos of being generous and helping others.
And do you think reaching out to their communities, not just equestrian communities, but communities where they live, is helpful in growing and shaping opinions and, you know, I guess, just being involved?
I mean, I believe, like, hard stop, the more nights people spend in their own bed, the better our sport can be. Like, because it creates so much more opportunity. Everyone says our sport's so expensive. It is. It's never going to be cheap. But it's infinitely more expensive when we have people traveling all the time and staying in hotels. And then you need parents. And then you have, you know, everyone's like, well, I don't know about the safe sport thing with this many kids or whatever. But, like, if they're showing somewhere locally and they can go home and have dinner with their family and be in their own bed, like, these aren't even concerns. Like, we've made the sport so complicated by needing to go places all the time. And going places is fun and amazing, and we all should continue doing it. But I think we all need to think about the travel time as time that we don't get back. We're not horse training. You know, if I took all my travel time and put it into riding, I'd probably ride well at this point, you know? And those are choices I made, you know? And so I think that a little more awareness on, like, what is and isn't needed. And, you know, and I would love to see programs, instead of trying to do it all, shift a little bit. I would love to see people in various stages be able to get more opportunity at more local shows. And I think there's a place for everyone and everything. And if we're going to continue growing, we need affordable options that are doable, both time-wise, you know, both time affordable, financially affordable, and kind of effort affordable, like getting your whole family to some horse show when only one of your kid rides. Like, that's not effort affordable for most people.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about local community and trying to get them more involved, and we're talking about trying to make this sport, you know, look okay to the general public, I think that's what's needed, really. If we can get people who know nothing about horses, who know nothing about taking care of animals, you know, coming out to the farm or coming out to a local show, seeing how much people love the animals, seeing the animals go around, you know, happy, healthy, whatever, I think that makes a big difference. And especially if barns are supporting other local businesses, and in turn, you know, the local businesses can support the local horse shows, that sort of thing. It, you know, being part of your community like that makes a big difference. I think a lot of these horse shows kind of set themselves apart, and a lot of horse shows have no local sponsorships. You know, like, they want the big cars or airlines or whatever it is. They want tons of money, and they don't think to go, you know, down the street for somebody who can, you know, provide a free breakfast for the exhibitors every morning. It's, you know, those little things that I think could make a bigger difference and ingratiate our industry with people who may never ride a horse, but could make a big difference in making sure that this sport can keep going.
Yeah, I think that we're really losing that, like, grassroots, but I think it's across the entire industry, to be honest with you, because there started to be, like, these mega barns in Reining, in the racetrack, standardbred, thoroughbred. People have 30, 50 head of horses, and those small mom and pop groups that go to the county fairs and race at the county fairs or ride. I mean, there used to be so many county fair horse shows, and I think that they're dying. And I think that the local shows are dying because people aren't going to it. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have this idea of grandeur, like everybody wants to be at the big A show, and not everybody should be or can be. I mean, I was just thinking about this actually after we had set this podcast and kind of what we wanted to talk about it. And I was like, you know, I was driving by a place that has trail rides. And I was like, you know, like, there's not enough of those type of businesses. Like, people aren't doing those things. Like, why? Like, we need to get them to like interact and make it accessible. It's becoming so expensive, and we're losing the lower end where people could afford to do it.
And I want to say welcome to everyone. I think a lot of the big horse shows aren't that welcome. And I think
exactly
the smaller shows have ways. Like, a lot of them don't even have signs when you pull in that say like anything. And I think, you know, so many of us like feel more at home at a local horse show or welcomed or, you know, and that's a big generalization. But I think that the more people we can bring in, I mean, when I talk to college students and they ask what to do in this sport, I'm like, find four Shetland ponies and like do pony rides and do a pony wheel and have a big poster up about this is a pony's life every day, you know, educate the people that come about how the ponies on the pony wheel have a great life. And they come out and do pony wheel one day a week, two days a week, whatever, at the farmer's market. And, you know, I think that everyone is obsessed with things that are scalable and comps. And like, we've made this like our entire industry, like a private equity group real estate transaction. But like, there's no comps for doing good in your community. There's no, you know, it's not scale. And education has never and will never be scalable. It's not. A lot of smart people have tried. It's not. We all need to learn on a one-on-one basis, spend time with other people. You know, you can learn things in the classroom, but you know, it's never going to be mass scalable. And I think making some of these businesses and making people who don't know horses feel welcome and feel included, the more of that stuff we can do, I think the better our sport becomes at every level, the more people join us and are interested. And, you know, I think, and I'm a complete, and I will say this for the record, I'm a complete 100% hypocrite. Like, I show at the big shows, I don't practice. I don't have a horse local to my house. I had this whole infrastructure built from before I moved, and I love every aspect of it, and I haven't changed any of it. My horses are really happy. And like, but I do think about it when I go to these shows, like, would I be completely happy doing some of these shows, you know, instead of what I do? And I think the answer is yes, but I also haven't done it yet. So I'm a complete 100% hypocrite in all this. But I went to a local show last weekend, and they roped off on the grass a ring, and it had ups and downs and was hard to ride in. And they did the 3/6 metal McClay, you know, all the equitation, all the 3/3, all the 3-foot metals, and did all the classes. And it was hard. And I also love that about the local shows. I think sometimes the course design is a lot harder and a lot more interesting at these lower level things that we have tried to make such a corporate machine out of the big shows that the courses are boring and it's so formulaic. And I think that misses kind of the magic of what we were all trying to do here in the first place.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's what I showed at when I was a junior. Yeah. I distinctly, exactly what you just said, yep, was like a chain rope that they just put out in a field. And I was jumping 3/6 metal courses on my junior hunter there. And they were not easy. And it was, like you said, like complete rolling ground.
I remember, I don't know.
And that's why I never qualified for an equitation final.
Yeah, I did a lot of pony club too on my horse. But I was thinking like about 15 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, I went to the Hampton Classic with a friend and we were watching the equitation class and they're going around in the big ring and kids are falling off and horses are stopping and they had the bank and they had all these different
open
things.
Water.
And I was like, oh my God, like I could do that with my horse when I was a kid. Like, he was not the most expensive horse, but he was a very honest horse. And we did all of that stuff, riding in pony club. I did, you know, the equitations, everything. And I was like, Owen never would have stopped at any of this. And I couldn't believe, I mean, these people were probably paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for these horses that were just stopping and kids were getting unloaded. And then I remember an article coming out after that and a trainer writing that they went home and they redesigned their entire course, like field course, to like include some of those elements because their kids struggled so poorly at the Hampton Classic with it.
Yeah. It's interesting.
But I mean, also, right? So shows want it to be boring and easy because they don't want complaints from competitors because they don't want things like that happening where everybody's stopping. But is that really like helping us as horsemen?
Exactly. And I think also, I mean, what we expect out of local show horses, like most of our rated show horses, name a rated show horse, like that can just come off the trailer and like go horse show.
Right.
Like that's not how they're even trained anymore. They're so used to having a few days to settle in and like going in the ring five times and then finally horse showing after, you know, many, many rides to acclimate. And yeah, I want to ask more out of people. And I think I don't want to scare them. I don't want people to get hurt, but also like, that's why there's so many divisions and you can literally show all the way down to the crossrails. Like you can choose something appropriate for you, but if something's going to be hard, like let's have it be hard. Yeah. They just, for the Pony Derby, they did a $9,000 USHA Pony Derby at Ledges in Chicago a week ago. And they used the bank there for that. And they let the pony school all week on it and stuff. And it was great, you know? So they opened up the Grand Prix ring and Hunter One and to be a massive ring. Absolutely, the small ponies were like lost out there. It was so many strides. But yeah, and then they went up the bank and did a jump on top of it, and then the handy they went, you know, down the bank, and then did, you know, they did a jump the other way. And yeah, like let's make things harder. Let's make it a challenge. Let's see who can rise to that challenge. When we have a sport of perfectionism, first of all, I think it encourages drugging, and I think that's wrong. And also it favors the billionaires, and then the sport feels more out of reach. When we have a sport of challenge, it favors the prepared and brave people, because you can buy perfectionism, you can't buy challenge.
So looking back at, you know, the local shows, or, you know, looking back at people who have businesses and want to be more locally involved in their community, do you have any tips on kind of getting the community to support equestrian activities?
I think you gotta get out there and put yourself out in front of people and get to know people. And it's kind of a slow process, and it shouldn't be that slow to want to volunteer or want to care, but it kind of is at this moment. You know, I've volunteered at local circuits all over the country, and I know a lot of people, but that didn't help me coming into my local community. I just kind of had to show up and show that I was serious and here, and I'm still not doing as much as I would love to help out with, but that'll come with time. I actually mentioned to Michael Lennard with Horse Spot recently, I was like, you should make like a volunteer portal and say like, I don't know if he's going to do it or not, but maybe this will prompt him. Because I would love something that said like, I'm available this weekend, you know, July 13th, and I will help out with anything at a farm or show, like within a 60-mile radius of my house, or, you know, like be able to like set some parameters like that. I think so many people want to volunteer, and so many people want to be helpful, and so many people want to be part of stuff, and we don't have a mechanism to include them. And again, I think that that's this bifurcation, like the big shows want everyone on staff and everyone accountable, right, and everyone to do things absolutely properly and correctly, because that's what people are paying for. But with this next tier of horse shows, like how do we make it more affordable? I think a lot of people would be helpful in that, you know, a lot of people would be part of that. The horse show I went to this past weekend has multiple trainers on site, and trainers were working the in-gate and sending people in the ring. But you can do stuff like that when it's a smaller show, when there are fewer rings going, when it's not as complicated. You know, I think there's a lot more leeway of doing things in less complicated ways when we just literally simplify the number of rings and the number of, we don't need to all horse show in the same place at the same time in the same location. Like it's just, you know, makes all our lives complicated. And again, that's time you never get back. That time you spend planning your day meticulously to the minute so that you get to every ring and everything and every, that's like, you look back on a year and you've spent so much time on that, and it's not time learning or training or getting better. It's time you've, you know, that just goes away.
Yeah.
That's how the eventing community works, right? I mean, most of the eventing competitions are completely volunteer run. You know, until you get into like the major level shows, but horse trials and things like that. And that's why I think so many of them are going away, is because it's very hard for them to find volunteers anymore. And I think like you said, if there were a way for people to find a way to go to these places or who needs volunteers, it could help them. But I think, you know, that's another idea for people who want to get more involved in their local equestrian community is don't stick to your own discipline. There's so many other ways, you know, equestrian is not just the way you ride a horse. It's so many other ways.
Yeah, I can learn a lot from a lot going and sitting and being a scribe at a dressage show.
Yeah. Scribes are always volunteers.
Yeah. And
yeah, just watching hundreds of people do a training level test, you learn what's good and what's not.
And I have a friend who comes from the standardbred background, and she's retired from the police force, like working with the horses. And she scribes for, she lives in Southern Pines now, and she scribes for the driving shows, which she thought was like a really cool, like different, you know, along the lines, watching them drive and stuff, because she likes that. But yeah, she scribes for that. So I think there's lots of opportunities if people look. And I also think, like, you kind of have to think outside of the equestrian industry, because look at how all these other organizations run with kids' sports, right? From volunteers for baseball, little league, flag football, and the football leagues. I mean, most of those are run off of volunteers too.
Almost entirely, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, they do the fundraising, and it also gives parents probably a way to fundraise and to make their kids be able to do the sport. I mean, I was thinking about, I have a friend whose daughter just wants to ride. She's not looking to be competitive. She just likes to ride. And, you know, I know her mom can't give her lessons to be competitive, and the kid's fine with that. But like, she would be the type of person who would roll up her sleeves and volunteer. She'd love to run a gate or learn how to run a gate, you know, the organized person who would like to see it, because that's her one complaint to me all the time about this sport is it's so disorganized. Like, she's like, give me a schedule, like 6 months. What, like, if my kid wants to go to a competition, I want to make it happen. So tell me what it's going to take and what the date of that is. And I'm like, unfortunately, they may not know. 6 months out. Like, we're like, for being organized horse shows, they're not really organized. Like, yeah. I said, it's kind of hard to like guess. And she was like, and what time am I supposed to be there? And I was like, also, good question.
That is one thing I think we can do. Like, the European shows, I haven't checked this morning, but I'm like positive that Ocket already has a 2026 date up on their website. Like, the European shows are like, so like, you will be here in 1 year. Like, this is what's happening. And then I check like 3 months before like Derby finals, and it hasn't changed over from last year.
Yeah. Yeah. I had somebody recently say something to me about website not being updated. And I was like, oh, I mean, I'm sorry. Wasn't my job to do it, but
yeah,
like, that's the horse showing for you.
Yep. And yeah, I think, you know, there's,
I just definitely checked, it is. sorry to interrupt, but yeah, no, May 22nd to 24th, 2026. It's on their website.
Awesome. Perfect. Like you said, there's so many opportunities for people who want to get involved in the equestrian industry to volunteer and to help, and for those with equestrian businesses to kind of find a way to involve their local community at their farm too. You know, it goes both ways. And I think you need that. I've done a couple different marketing seminars and things like that for equestrians. And one of the things we always talk about for small businesses is, if you are, especially if you're running like local shows and things like that, is always go out to your local businesses and see if they'll sponsor something at your show, because, you know, they're reaching an audience there. And that's, I think, one of the untapped ways that most equestrians don't think of when they're thinking about sponsorships. So,
yeah. And then I also think, though, that shows have to provide something good for their sponsorships. As somebody who does a lot of different sponsorships, the return. It doesn't have to be there immediately, but you want to see something being done, like the deliverables being met at least, right? They have to be deliverables that are good for both parties.
Did you mean follow through?
Yes.
Follow through. What a novel idea.
Piper, you mentioned that in an email to us about a couple of events that you've gone to. And I was wondering if you wanted to kind of elaborate on them a little bit about maybe getting out and going to other events that could be supportive of your community.
I've also met a lot of people doing so many various things in our community. There's so many great therapeutic riding centers around here. And a couple of weeks ago, I got to go visit Pegasus Therapeutic Riding Center in Brewster and see on the grounds and meet the horses. And they have an absolutely huge program. They bring in so many school children and all the things that we're talking about, how to bring more people in. I think one of the big things too in our industry is that, you know, we want something and so we want to invent it ourselves and we get so siloed. So many people are doing great things in the community. If you want to do something great, if you pitch me an idea ever, the first thing I say back to you is like, look for someone who's already doing it and help them. So many people are doing amazing things. And then there's Endeavor Therapeutic Riding Program, which specifically works with soldiers and PTSD and members of our armed forces coming back and adjusting back to society. And I went to one of their events a couple weeks ago. It wasn't at the barn with the horses. It was at someone's house, but they did bring the minis over to parade around. And seeing these organizations so close to me, getting so much done and being so productive in the community, I think that's amazing. And then that further connection, we talk about little things like that further connection between those organizations and show barns might mean, you know, a horse gets donated here or there. And these are small things in the grand scheme of things of everybody, but on the micro scale, like for this horse's life to have a next career, for everyone who gets to interact with that horse, for everyone who gets to be part of it, you know, I think that's huge. And if we can kind of come together a little bit and find more ways to keep, you know, our horses in steady and good work. I was at a barn recently and saw my friend's old horse who is 28 years old. And he could have looked 14. I mean, he looked amazing. And I was like, oh my gosh, what are you doing with this horse? And she said, the secret is we ride him lately 5 days a week. Like he wants to keep going. He's happy. He gets as much turnout as we can give him. And, you know, I don't like by keeping going, he is a lot happier and he has a purpose and he goes on the cross ties every day and gets groomed and he loves the attention and he's thriving at 28. And is that all horses? No, but for those specific horses, I mean, there's so many lesson barns or places where they can be ethically cared for in their golden years to a pinnacle of care. And I think figuring out those places and those pipelines, it is amazing because every horse with a job tends to have a good life, and horses who don't have a purpose or job, reality is they are less guaranteed a good life, which is really sad.
Yeah, I work with Days End Farm Horse Rescue, who you know, Piper, and the amount of creative ideas and things that they do in their local community and fundraisers and ways that they, you know, find to bring people in is enormous. It's amazing. And I think if you ever want to know how to get involved with your local community or find ways to, you know, creatively bring people to your farm, then look at a nonprofit around you, because they're the ones who really have to hustle to make money and to, you know, raise money for them for what they do. And there's some great ways to do it. And I think if you can also find a way to support them and, you know, maybe get together on an event that helps both of you, those sorts of things are great ideas as well.
Collaboration.
Yeah. And Day's End is so systematic about the volunteers. I mean, they all have like colors of like what, you know, because they have non-horse people that can help, you know, with yard work and that kind of stuff. And then they have like people who can lightly handle easy horses. And And I like, they're very structured for volunteers, which, and so is Pegasus, which is awesome. But that's a lot of work on the front end.
Yeah. And sometimes, I'm on the board of Purple Hay Standard Bread Adoption Program. And it's very hard because our director, she's also in the barn mucking stalls and managing the horses, lives on the farm. And then for her to have to organize, like, we do get volunteers, which is awesome and we love it. But that level of organization, you know, it'd be great if there was like somebody who would volunteer to organize all that stuff on top of it, you know. And as a board member, it's hard to be hands-on. It's a couple of hours away from me. So like being there on a weekly basis or monthly basis is kind of hard. And for most of the board members, but yeah, the volunteers it's so important. And I really, even sitting on the board is an important role of, you know, trying to come up with these ideas to get to interact with the community. And also, you know, after we had our last podcast about like influencing, I was like, ooh, is there an opportunity for some of these rescues to like make money off of that part of it? You know, like the creator fund or whatever, if they can have people following along with their stories, because we're always looking for lots of different revenue streams to come into those. And so we're kind of pursuing some of that with Purple Haze.
So Piper, how long have you had the Plaidcast podcast?
Over 9 years. We have never been late or missed a Friday in over 430 Fridays.
That's incredible.
It's impressive. Man, we're only twice a month and whew.
Yeah,
my God, we can't do it. I tell everyone all the time, I'm like, anyone can put out a better magazine than I can if they sat down and did it. That's not the hard part. Anyone can put out a great podcast. That's not the hard part. The hard part is doing it over and over and over and over and over and over. And I recently put out my 100th issue of the Plaid Horse in April this year. And yeah, and we're going to close in on 500. We've already done 500 podcasts, but 500 Friday podcasts will close in on soon.
Wow.
So,
yeah,
amazing.
I think we'll be dead before we do 500 podcasts. Well, maybe not. I guess we're at 93. That's not totally.
We just got to keep doing it for another, I don't know, 20 years.
But so for, you know, for what the Plaidcast offers you in terms of reach, the ability to talk to so many different people, why did you decide to start hosting the in-person Plaidcast?
The in-person podcast was something I was always interested in, you know, years ago. I had gone to a couple of other podcasts and in kind of that 2016, 2017 timeframe. And that's where I always saw the podcast going from the beginning. As we talked about before, like you need to have the business infrastructure to start a new project to, you know, to bring on volunteers or bring on something else. And I didn't have the people or the infrastructure with everything else I was trying to do and some other like failed projects that I probably could have skipped in hindsight. And I'm not sure also like that I'm pretty good at not doing things before I'm ready. And I'm not sure I also like had the confidence and that kind of readiness to manage the whole operation. I think at some level I knew that. I'm not sure if like you would ask me then if I would have been able to say that, but I think subconsciously. And then kind of as I was starting to get ready, it was when the pandemic happened. So that was, you know, out. And again, it wasn't clear living, you know, so remotely, like, you know, it would be so many logistics to like fly in somewhere and manage it. And I wouldn't be able to really check the space beforehand. And, you know, and there were a lot of unknowns. And so I think a big part of moving here and being able to see the space and, you know, if there's any issues, I can check in. That's really nice. And then I don't have to deal with. So the first two podcast lives we had ended up being fine, but both of them, the morning of, the guest called and said they wouldn't be able to make it.
Oh my God. How?
Yeah. Tick Maynard's flight was canceled because he hit a traffic jam on the Florida Turnpike, and it was just stopped dead, and he missed his flight. And He didn't think he could make it and ended up spending a ton of money putting him on to another flight and here on time. But it was looking for a while like he wouldn't even be able to get here. And so, like, I just would rather be home when things like that happen. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, at the command center, you know, have all my computers and all my monitors and figure stuff out. And that stuff happens, you know, and so, and also get back to the confidence thing. Had that happened to me in 2019, I would have like, I would have passed away. I would have just, and like, yeah, me at this age, I was like, okay, we're handling, we'll figure it out. Yeah. And, you know, and I think the only consequence was what, like, attendance wasn't, because normally I call people day of, as I'm doing today. We have one tonight, and I'm going to be calling people and being like, please show up, please show up. I'm begging. And I wasn't able to do that because I was dealing with that all day. And so I think attendance was a little later. But other than that, I mean, no one knew about it. It was fine. And so, yeah, I always wanted it to be this community aspect. But I think I didn't understand the importance then of a lot of what we were doing in the early days. We were very early on to social media. I think the Plaid Horse was one of the first big Instagram accounts in the industry. Mm-hmm. And we leveraged that, and it was so novel and new. And it so many people were in person, and then you didn't have access to people outside your region. So you didn't have access to the knowledge and the understanding and wanting to do things in our sport. Now that script is completely flipped. Everyone has access to anything under the sun, and what they're missing is that in-person thing. And, you know, and we're not stuck on business model or business plans. We haven't talked much about business, but we have no investors, and I have no debt in the Plaid Horse, and I also have no safety net. So if I can't pay the bills at the end of the month, no one cares. So I have to get that done. But other than that, I can pivot, I can switch gears, I can talk about different things, I can change anything I want whenever I want. And I think the big shift now is that we try to give people what they don't have to make the industry better. And what they didn't have was access, you know, 10 years ago. Now they have a ton of access. What they need now is deeper and more real relationships. And that's given me kind of the wherewithal to try to start an in-person event in 20. We started it last year, but like, yeah, in-person events in 2025. Like, kind of sounds as dumb as buying a print magazine in 2014.
But that magazine's still going.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And so how many in-person podcasts have you done now?
We did one in Wellington this winter at the Horse Show. And we did two, one in November, December last year. And then we have 8 on the docket this year at the Wadsworth. And we're doing... We did one in June that Jen went to. We have 2 in July. We have a series of 4 in September. And then we have one in November that's on the Friday night of Equine Affair. So we know a lot of people will be in town for that. We're going to go on the road at Greer School. We're doing one at Spy Coast Farm during Pony Finals in August. So it's really taking off. And, you know, thankfully, I have the infrastructure at the rest of the company to allow me to spend the time getting this to take off, because it's not a trivial feat.
Yeah. And when you were talking about, you know, your business structure and being able to do this, how are you able to make it free for people to come to these?
I just spend my own money. Like, I am spending, you know, Plaid Horse money. There's no secret. I think it's valuable, and so we're doing it. It's that simple. And we've always kind of run like that. And I would keep them free forever if we can. I mean, we'll see demand. I would love to partner with charities. So if you all know of anyone or anyone listening wants to let me know a charity, if we could make tickets $5 or $10 and have all that money go to, you know, a charity each time, I'd be totally open to that once we get them going and the crowd fall a little bit. But I don't want a barrier on education. I want anyone to learn, to be able to show up. And I think this is kind of, to me, the cost of doing business. This is part of the Plaid Horse, and I'm just going to spend money on it. And there's not an ROI on everything we do.
Yeah, it reminds me of what our speaker, Carol Cohn, at the EQBW brunch, she talked about how businesses, you know, have to have something to stand for these days. And that's what they're, you know, what their customers expect from companies these days, and to stand for something and to put their money behind something, some kind of societal issue or a cause that they believe in, and taking part of that profit, and whether it's supporting charities or making a difference somewhere. But, you know, I think that is a great way. I think, like you said, you may be hypocritical in the way that I don't particularly find it hypocritical, but you found what works for your horse to be able to stay in a program that works, and you show at the bigger shows, but yet you support local horse shows very much. But, you know, you're taking your business and putting money into these events because you see the value in doing more in-person events, and find that is a great way for people to learn and make connections in this industry. And it's important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I also, I mean, I'm happy to share, like, I don't profit really at all. And I think it's important that we're clear about that with some equestrian businesses when we talk business. Some mm-hmm. people do various businesses, and I think that's great, and I structure them for how they work with their lives. But, you know, everyone at the Plaid Horse makes more than I do. I scrap it together every month. And, you know, there's no like dream career financially. I love this and I want to do it every day. And that's what I get to do every day. And I feel so fortunate. And these are all choices that I've made. But, you know, when that's how we're able to invest in growth, invest in Podcast Live, print more magazines, you know, invest in other people in various ways.
Right. Your educational grants that you do.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Educational grants, our business contest, our writing contest. So that was a $10,000 contest last year for the writing contest. And our winner, I love this so much. Our winner was a vet who donated her $5,000 grand prize to two vet students as a scholarship. So that made me so happy.
Yeah. Amazing.
And so we do a lot of different things in the community, but I think, you know, we all get a little like lost sometimes in what businesses are or aren't. And when you're analyzing for structuring your own business, you know, what makes sense for you and how mm-hmm. does that work?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think, you know, this conversation could go on forever because there's so much to it. And, you know, anyone who wants to feel like they want to reach out and make those connections, we highly recommend going to the in-person podcasts. But for our conversation today, we'll wrap up with our questions at the end. We ask every guest, so Connor starts with the first.
What is your unfair advantage over others?
I forget everything bad that's ever happened to me. I literally just don't remember it. And
amazing.
I start every day with a blank slate, excited. I don't know if this is rehearsed or like mental illness, but it really helps me. And it's such an unfair advantage because I literally can't remember what someone said to me 2 years ago.
So good.
I remember everything important, nothing I deem unimportant.
I'm sure that helps.
Yep.
And what's something worth fighting for, and what is something worth giving up?
I think it's worth fighting for everyone to have the opportunity to have access to horses in some manner in their life. I think horses make every one of our lives better. And the more people we can welcome to the community, we should all fight for that. One thing I think is not worth fighting for is our appearance. We're all in this vortex of thinking that our own appearance is so important. And I'm part of it. And I hate it. And I hate it for girls. And I hate it for women of all ages. And I hope that we can all just kind of collectively take a deep breath and remember that we all have so much value that's not our physical selves.
I like that. Awesome. What has been your favorite age so far?
I would say right now I have grown more in the last 12 months than probably any other age in my life. I still grow more every year than I think is possible. And I'm really enjoying, I spent so many years being really bad at this. I was so incompetent. And I'm fairly competent right now at the basics, which has its own host of things, trying to, you know, work with other people and grow and as the world changes. But it's a lot more comfortable for me being competent and getting to make these decisions than prior points in my history.
Do you mean as like a business owner or in the horse industry?
All of the above, I think. Yeah. You know, yeah, as a publication. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing at all, and I didn't know what I didn't know. And I just struggled at everything for so many years, but it all kind of came together.
Yeah. And who would you recommend as a guest for this podcast?
I don't think you've had her, but I would absolutely recommend Megan Rollins, the course designer. She is incredibly gifted. She does such a good job, and she is the greatest mentor. She has so many people that she has mentored through their course designer license, so many women especially, but everyone. She takes the time to help anyone who's interested in course design or wants to grow and puts a ton of effort into them. And I commend, as we've talked about, education is not scalable, and she's made such a huge difference in so many people's lives by letting them in and opening up and, you know, bringing them into her world of course design.
That's awesome. She's a course designer at the Saratoga Women in Business show as well.
Oh, cool. Oh, yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, it's been awesome to talk with you about this subject. I think, you know, people should continue this conversation and find ways, you know, to reach out, whether it's volunteering or starting their own, you know, their own meetups and their own ways to bring community together. So we appreciate you coming on today. And it was fun talking with you.
Yeah, thanks so much. I can't wait for another podcast in person. So.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Hey, if you're over the sugar-coated stories and want the real unfiltered side of the horse world, come ride with us.
I'm Maria Falgioni, former jockey turned businesswoman.
And I'm Cheyenne Wimberly, rail racer and rodeo veteran.
We're pulling back the curtain on the horse world, the wins, the wild stories, and the things nobody else wants to say out loud.
Serious topics, zero stuffy vibes.
Search Gallop and Gossip wherever you get your podcast, and bring your tea, because we've got plenty to spill.
It's kind of hard to believe we haven't had Piper on the podcast yet.
I know.
We're both on Horse Radio Network, Plaidcast is, and I don't know.
We've known her for like ever.
Forever. Yeah. And yeah, I remember when she told me she was buying the Plaid Horse magazine, however many years ago that was, 11 years ago, I think. So yeah, it was cool to talk to her about this particular subject, because it obviously fits in with what we try to do as well, and having our in-person events and our meetups. And, you know, it's something we try to fit into our schedule, our busy schedules, and it's something that we want to do more of. And so I think you've been more successful than me at it in trying to, you know, do more yourself in your area. And I don't feel like I have that in my area. I don't hang out with equestrians in Jacksonville, Florida. I know of a few, but I don't like go out and mingle with them. So,
I mean, my job is pretty much in mingling with equestrians, right?
So. True. Yes, that's true.
Puts me in a bit of a different spot, but no,
I see them when I travel to other places.
Yeah. Equestrians in the wild.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I mean, I really loved, so I had the opportunity to go to her live podcast, in-person podcast at the theater in Hartford, Connecticut, and it was well worth it. I mean, it was like a trip out there, do the podcast, you listen to the podcast, and then turn around and come home. So it was like a long day for me, but it was well worth it, because it wasn't just
the speakers and what I got out of that, which was a lot because it was interesting and it was about technology in the equine space, which was really cool. And then she also had like the absolute opposite, having Dawn Stewart there to speak.
Who is maybe not the most technological person.
Correct. So,
I'm guessing.
Yeah, so it was very interesting, but I appreciated the conversation, especially between the two groups, but also networking with the people who were there, which, I mean, we know that I love to network. So that was like the easy part and super enjoyable. And, you know, it makes me like, so I'm so curious because next week I am going to a live podcast in New York City and it's at Radio City Music Hall. And it's so it's for a big podcast, but I'm really curious because this will only be my second experience of going to a live podcast to see like the differences and how they did it and, you know, the format and the setup and everything. I always find that so interesting. And then, you know, I hope to make more of Piper's in the future too, just because it's like great community. But for her to like put that together and then also have us be like a patron of the theater and museum that she hosted at is super cool. Like she obviously went out in her community and found something that's willing to work for her. And on the podcast, I love how she answered the question about it being free. And it is, it's like part of doing business, I think at this point, giving back. Which is amazing.
Yep. I like what she's trying to do with getting people back together and doing things in person, because I do agree with her in how much social media seems to be pulling us apart now. Whereas I will say there are very good parts to social media in ways that it can connect you to people that it would never, you would have never meet in real life. And, you know, ways to crowdsource information and there are good parts to it, but I do feel that it can add to people's isolation and loneliness and to counteract that of being able to go to events like these and to maybe encourage people to do their own events with their business or to volunteer and get out there more within their community is really admirable. And I think could only help our industry. And I think our industry is at the point where it really needs this help. It needs not only our community all trying to find a way to improve it and our social license to keep going, but it needs, you know, more people, even if they're never going to ride a horse, to appreciate the sport and the animals and what we do.
Yeah, I think I have a couple of things to say about this. One, going back to kind of our last episode where being a good steward of animals and showing that and being able to connect with people outside is so important because we've kind of lost that here in the US, right? They have, it's much different in Europe. And, you know, it's common to see farm animals and horses. And just when you go to shows in Europe, it's so different than here in the US. We live in a bubble, a silo, in our horse shows. So I think that getting people out there to see the animals and interact is really, really important.
Do you think though that's at least, I think that's only in certain parts of the country and I think that's only in certain disciplines, don't you?
Yeah, I could say that. Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think, like you said, in our bubble of hunter jumper and in our bubble of East Coast.
Right.
And being in somewhat metropolitan areas.
Yeah.
Yes, I do think it's like that. I think if you're more, and I realize you kind of grew up in a more rural area, but I do think in other areas, there are many more people who have access to animals.
Oh, I think they have access to it. But also, you have to think about, like, we've had such a push for everybody to, like, go off to college and everything and get educated that, like, but kids are leaving farms.
Yeah.
And they're not becoming fifth generation farmers anymore because they're looking at going into something different because it's hard. So maybe they've grown up where they're...
Well, that's a whole other conversation.
Exactly.
Farmers being forced off their land.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I do think, yes, but I do think that, you know, we've shifted from, like, a lot of places, even if they are agricultural, of not wanting to stay in it. But I also was thinking about when she was talking about the, like, getting better and that percent of getting better and if she could make herself 1%. And it was making me think about this book that I read a while ago called Atomic Habits. And that's basically the theory is getting 1% better. And I really believe that if you can try and improve yourself, and if it's 1% a year or 1% a day or 1% a month, like, think about that. If it was only improving something 1% a month, that's still 12% growth in a year. That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a good way to look at it.
So I think that that's, that was a really good point that she made about that.
Yeah.
And then also with, like, getting out there and doing things in the community, like you were talking about with our horse shows, I think that is a real need. I think, like, we're talking about the bubble. We're so focused on equine. And I think that you and I aren't, because we brought in plenty of people who are, have something related to the equine industry, but they don't have to have a business in the industry, right? Like, we want those lawyers, real estate agents, people who work for the UN or something different, you know, doing a different job. We like to have those conversations because we like to network with those people and kind of get their ideas about the state of the equine industry and what they can bring to it from outside businesses, right?
And how does their work apply to what horse people do, or how can we take their skills and their experience and their knowledge and use it in the jobs that we do in the equestrian industry?
Right. And then I also think too, we've been able to spread the message that, you know, you don't have to feel stuck in this industry because you have developed good skills in this industry and how to take those skills and apply them to, you know, outside things if you weren't wanted to leave the equine industry, or you want to just keep your toe in being just, you know, a horse owner, a rider, whatever, and go off and do other things. Kind of like, you know, we took a lot of the skills that we had from riding and we've put it into, like, the work that we do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For a career.
Yeah. So I think, one of my favorite answers was her unfair advantage answer. That was amazing. I wish I had that skill of being able to just forget anything bad and just move on.
Right? Oy, yes.
Not dwell over it.
Not, like, dwell.
That's amazing. Like, not have the conversations in my head over and over and over again.
Yep. For sure. And not beat myself up over it. That is, like she said, I don't think she knows how it happens or where she got it from or why, but
that was so funny. I love that part of it. Yeah. It was a really great conversation, and I think it's such an important one to have. And, you know, I hope that people take away that they should get out there. And I mean, I'm also going to say that I think that you should get out there and experience things like expos or conferences or trade shows that are not equine related, because I think that gives you another perspective as well. Go listen to a speaker. You know, I'm actually thinking about going to a couple this summer in my local area. They're running, like, a business through the Chamber of Commerce, like, business talks. Like, once a month they have a speaker. And I was like, oh, this is something that I should go to. If there's a topic that I think is relatable to me, then yeah, I think that I'm going to try and make a point to go to something like that because you don't know what you can gain from going and interacting in the community. So I think people should look for those as well.
Yep. I think there's so many opportunities out there, and we've had guests who have recommended that as well. You know, there's a lot of free education out there if you just look for it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be strictly equine related. Like you said, Chamber of Commerce events and seminars can be hugely helpful for, you know, if starting a business or, you know, helping with various elements of your business, even if your business doesn't exactly serve very many of your local community.
You
know, if you have a local barn or something like that. But there's lots of ways. It just takes some effort and putting yourself out there, which is, I think, is difficult for a lot of people.
But
you know, it doesn't have to be an everyday thing. It can be a once a month thing or a once a quarter thing, and challenge yourself and see what you get out of it.
Yeah, for sure. Challenge. That's important. Well, we're going to wrap up today because I have to go to the eye doctor. So maybe I can see some stuff now.
Because you're an old lady.
I'm an old lady. I need some glasses, I think. So find the links to today's guests and the show notes at www.eqbusinesswomen.com. Equestrian B2B is out twice a month on the 1st and the 15th.
You can find out more at eqbusinesswomen.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Find Equestrian B2B wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow, subscribe, and leave a review.
Now go show up in person.